You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Now, in 2022, half of all U.S. renters paid more than 30% of their income on housing. That's a new all-time record, according to a new report from the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. An expert on the housing market is here to talk about why rent is now considered unaffordable for a significant portion of Americans and how rental markets in Wisconsin compare to the rest of the country. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What portion of your income is spent on rent? Do you think you're getting what you pay for? What have you had to do to make rent more affordable? Have you had to find roommates, work extra hours, or live somewhere that's not ideal for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Shereen. Thanks for having me.
How do researchers decide, really, what's considered unaffordable in reports like the one we're looking at here? What factors are in play?
Yeah, so given that it's Groundhog Day, I feel like that Bill Murray character, every day is the same. We keep talking about this for years and years, and yet it seems to have gotten worse in the last year or two. So researchers use the same data that government programs do, which is this general rule that says you should spend no more than 30% of your income on rent. And that's largely driven by the understanding that when you spend more than that on rent, you don't have enough left over for the other necessities of life, like food, transportation, education, and healthcare.
And are they looking at income as net income or gross income when they're yes, putting that together?
Right. So it's a technical term that comes from the census, and we use it in HUD data. So it would generally be pre-tax income, right? Mm-hmm. And that would include income like disability, alimony, but it's not going to include tax credits or things like Medicaid or the value of health insurance. So it's what we call money income. It's the money that comes in, but that's part of the problem, right? Because it doesn't adjust for tax differences based on your family size or other characteristics.
I feel like it is Groundhog Day, that we've been hearing this over and over and over again, but much more so in the last couple of years. And I'm sure this is a complex question, but what factors have caused this spike in rent, especially in the last couple of years?
Right. So we can think about long-term structural forces, which is that rental demand has been high and continued to remain high for the last 10 years. And that's driven by job growth in places like your report was just indicating, that strong job growth in the United States, and particularly demographics. We have millennials, the largest generation, which normally would own a home, but they're staying in the rental market because they can't find a place to own. So that's the long-term structural imbalance between supply and demand. In the last couple of years during the pandemic, surprisingly, rental demand skyrocketed during the pandemic, as the report from Harvard talks about. This was largely driven by people wanting to make sure that they stayed where they lived and did not necessarily want to have to get a roommate, because obviously that exposes you to more COVID. So rental demand skyrocketed at the same time that supply was impacted. That was 2021 and the first half of 2022. Then as prices skyrocketed in 2022, and as a lot of the emergency supports from the COVID pandemic disappeared, then rental demand actually went pretty low. And I realize those are kind of big term and structural forces, but for the average person, right, you're just looking at trying to find a place to rent, and it's hard to know whether the market in a year from now will be up or down. When people go to try to find a place to rent, it's largely driven by the vacancy rate in the city that you're trying to rent in. right? So when vacancy rates are high, there's a lot of choices. Tenants have some pricing power and can choose better places. But when vacancy rates are really low, then tenants get desperate and landlords have more pricing power. So it's a lot of things changing all at once.
Do you have a sense of how the housing demand and rent affordability in Wisconsin compare to the rest of the country? Are we all kind of in the same boat, or is it different here?
Well, we are kind of in the same boat, and it's different here in the sense that you have counties like Dane County and Waukesha County and parts of the city of Milwaukee where rent growth has been 6 or even 10% just because incredibly strong demand coming from good employment, right? Rent growth has been very strong in the Green Bay, Appleton area, the Fox Cities, Fox Valley, in Eau Claire, in La Crosse. So rent in our urban areas has been pretty strong, and supply is trying to keep up. But of course, in a lot of our rural areas, we have not seen a lot of rental housing anyway. You don't see a lot of variations in rental demand. And so you can never think of the state as a whole because every market's different. But if you do look at the state as a whole, for the last 6 years, our vacancy rate of multifamily housing has been pretty low, below historic averages. That means that you're seeing prices go up and it's just harder for workers to find a place to live.
We have Daryl with us on the phone now. Daryl is calling from Menominee Falls. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, I'm a landlord and I have properties in the city of Milwaukee. And I always feel bad when I have to give my tenants a rent increase. But with the cost of everything rising continuously, I have no other avenue to go. The cost of materials have doubled. Water bills are really high. Taxes have gone up. Insurance has gone up. And it's a necessity. And I wish I could do it differently, but it's for me to stay in business, I have to do it. So,
right.
Yeah, thanks, Daryl. Kurt, I mean, what about those factors that are causing landlords like Daryl to have to increase their rent prices?
Right. That's the other part of this story, which is that the year-over-year increase in operating costs for rental housing in the state has gone up anywhere from 9 to 15%. And so as Daryl was saying, if your insurance costs have gone up, if your operating costs have gone up, material costs, labor costs, the employment costs, if your costs per unit go up $200, then you per month, you have to raise your rent about that same amount just to stay even. And so part of what is driving this is just the overall inflation in all these other costs. In particular, when the cost to build new rental housing goes up, then the price that people are willing to pay for the existing supply also goes up. So we have all these factors kind of pushing and pulling. And what Daryl is telling us is it's not just that landlords are trying to make excessive profit. Their costs really have gone up in significant amounts, at least a couple hundred dollars per unit in most places.
And what about the cost of constructing new apartments and apartment buildings? I mean, how has that affected things, too? We hear about that a lot, that the cost of building a new home or building an apartment complex has just absolutely skyrocketed as well.
Right. So the way to think about it is everything you try to build now is 35 to 40% more expensive than it was even 3 years ago. Right. So we talk a lot about vacancy and supply and demand determining the rent level. And so obviously in places where there's a lot of rent growth and a lot of people want to rent an apartment, developers want to build more apartments there to kind of meet that demand. But if the only thing they can build is really expensive, then that's only going to be able to cater to the high end of the market. And that continues to put a squeeze on everybody else. So it's, again, when the price to build a new home goes up, then people who might want to own a home stay in the rental market, and that also puts pressure on the rental market.
How do you think that will change over the, I mean, do you think that the cost of building an apartment, building a house will eventually go down, or does that just not happen? I had this conversation with my brother-in-law who was like, costs just don't go down.
Right. So in the last 6 months, the costs have not increased in the same way that rents in the last 6 months have not increased, but they tend to not go down from that high level, right? Unless we know or can think of some innovative way to build housing in a different way, it's still expensive, right? Because the cost of housing includes not just the land, it includes all of the labor. We have a labor shortage in construction. And it includes all the materials like drywall and cement and steel. And those have just been really accelerating in prices.
We're talking with Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, about why rent is now considered unaffordable for a record half of all U.S. renters. We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. If you're a renter, would you rather be a homeowner or vice versa? Do you live in a particularly expensive or inexpensive area? And did cost factor into why you chose to live there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, and we're talking about why housing is unaffordable for half of U.S. renters and how rent in Wisconsin compares to the rest of the country. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. How much money do you have left in your budget after rent? Are you receiving government rental assistance, and has it helped? Do you have any other questions or comments about the rental market in the U.S. or Wisconsin specifically? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kurt, what income brackets have been most affected by rising rent?
Right. So the report that you started off with from Harvard really looks at renters whose income is about $30,000 a year or less. And as you can imagine, when rent is expensive or apartments are in short supply, people with more income and more capabilities are the ones who get the housing. And then our lowest wage workers are the ones who get the squeeze, right? So for a household making $30,000 a year, that's about $14.50 an hour. That's what we would consider as the wage on average of a childcare worker or a home health care worker in Wisconsin, right? So we're talking about people who are in the labor market, performing these vital services, taking care of kids, taking care of our seniors, preparing food, a lot of the service industry work that we rely on. And that means that those workers cannot afford to live any place near where they work, or they have to spend more than half of their income on rent. So again, we see this, that people might have to double up. They might have to cut out other expenses for food or transportation. Or in extreme cases, they may live an hour away from work and have to drive. And of course, the most extreme version of housing insecurity is the fact that homelessness has been on the rise in the last year, largely driven by this increase in rent and the expiration of a lot of the pandemic era financial and rent supports.
And that was my next question for you about the connection with homelessness rising. We've been seeing a lot of that. How much of the rise in homelessness has to do with the cost of rent, do you think?
I think almost all of it has to do with the cost of rent, right? So when people think about homelessness, the way to think about it is that a city like Milwaukee in Wisconsin that has a higher poverty rate than Madison has a lower homelessness rate, right? It's really the availability and the price of housing that is the driver of the differences in homelessness and housing insecurity across regions, right? So if you think about nonprofits that are working with people experiencing homelessness, the ability to get them into a unit, or the ability to, for someone who is currently housed but maybe facing an eviction, to keep them housed, really depends on the availability of housing and the availability of support and resources. And it's just a lot harder to do that when rent is high and housing is in short supply.
What about rental assistance programs? Have those been able to kind of stem the gap here, or been able to keep up with the number of people unable to afford rent?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the report from Harvard talks a lot about that. So we should think about this in two terms. There's the long-term rental assistance and affordable housing programs, the biggest one of which is the voucher program, which helps to provide the difference between what would be affordable to a household and what the rent costs. And the voucher program is a vital and important resource for those families lucky enough to get it. But only about one in five households that whose income would make them eligible actually get any rental assistance at all. Now, during the pandemic, we tripled the size of the voucher program with the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which spent up to $45 billion on an emergency basis to help people pay the rent and stay stably housed. And that support was absolutely vital in helping folks to stay housed, to stay safe, to reduce the spread of disease. And what it shows us is that with a sufficient commitment of resources, we can significantly reduce the housing cost burden for the most vulnerable residents, right? And that's on top of the child care, the child tax credit, the various increases in unemployment insurance, and the eviction moratorium during the pandemic, right? So we had this experiment during the pandemic that really showed us what can be done if we're willing to spend the resources. Now, that raises the question of what we can do to kind of maintain and expand the housing assistance that we have. And in case you haven't noticed, Congress has not been very timely in getting a budget done, but they're working on a budget right now. And unfortunately, it seems like a lot of the expansion of the voucher program and rental assistance programs is not on the table.
We only have a few minutes left, but I want to make sure to take this call from Chuck in Chautauqua. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for calling.
Hi, it's Chuck in Chautauqua. Just know that people who are paying high rent have trouble saving money to get a mortgage, and that banks are pondering to apartment builders financing those, while people that want a single family home are having trouble getting a mortgage because they can't save up the money for the down payment. The other thing I wanted to mention is rental income. People who get rental income, they do not pay into the Social Security system because that's considered unearned income. And I know some people who've had rental incomes and then they go on Social Security and they're finding they're getting nothing.
So sure. Thank you, Chuck. Yeah. What do you think about what Chuck said about that connection there?
Right. So what Chuck is highlighting is our housing markets are deeply influenced by the financing systems and the tax code. And that's probably going to put a lot of people to sleep. But the main point is that for families trying to save for a down payment, rent increases really make it harder. And then the house you're trying to buy is more expensive. And with interest rates higher, your dollar goes less far. So there's kind of a triple whammy, a kind of a real barrier to a lot of people buying homes. Now, in terms of the tax code, most companies that are renting are going to be paying income tax on that rent. So if you're a mom and pop landlord and you're receiving rental income, you are paying income tax on that. But Chuck is right. That doesn't count as Social Security income that would then lead into your determination of your benefits in the future. So it gets more complicated than that, but discussion of tax code on a Friday afternoon is pretty hard to do. But I think the point is that there's such a strong demand for rental housing that banks are willing to lend to build apartments. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen in the last 6 months is that actually banks have really tightened up lending and the construction pipeline has started to shrink because for anyone building rental housing, it's not only expensive, but the cost of debt, interest rates, has really gone up. So what that means is that even though we need to build more, our supply in the future is starting to shrink, which means I'll be back next year for Groundhog's Day, and it'll be the same story.
Last 30 seconds, Kurt. Is there one thing that policymakers could do to solve this problem?
Well, so our legislature did pass $500 million, $500 million, in affordable housing funds over the summer, and those are starting to roll out. So some help is on the way. But I would urge everyone to contact your federal officials, your congressperson, and tell them to increase support for rental assistance so that our most vulnerable workers and families can afford a decent place to live.
Kurt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. He helped us break down why rent is now considered unaffordable for a record half of all U.S. renters.